And the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord after he had died. And the Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. The commander of his army was Sisera, who lived in Harosheth Hagoyim. Then the people of Israel cried out to the Lord for help, for he had 900 chariots of iron, and he oppressed the people of Israel cruelly for 20 years. Now Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lippadoth, was judging Israel at the time. She used to sit under the palm of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim. And the people of Israel came up to her for judgment. She sent and summoned Barak, the son of Abinoam, from Kadesh Naphtali, and said to him, "Has not the Lord, the God of Israel, commanded you? Go, gather your men at Mount Tabor, taking 10,000 from the people of Naphtali and the people of Zebulun. And I will draw out Sisera, the general of Jabin's army, to meet you by the river Kishon with his chariots and his troops, and I will give him into your hand." Barak said to her, "If you will go with me, I will go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go." And she said, "I will surely go with you. Nevertheless, the road on which you are going will not lead to your glory, for the Lord will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman." Then Deborah rose and went with Barak to Kadesh. And Barak called out Zebulun and Naphtali to Kadesh, and 10,000 men went up at his heels, and Deborah went up with him. Now Heber the Kenite had separated from the Kenites, and the descendants of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, and had pitched his tent as far away as the oaks of Zananim, which is near Kadesh. When Sisera told that Barak the son of Abinoam had gone up to Mount Tabor, Sisera called out his chariots, 900 chariots of iron, and all the men who were with him, from Harosheth Hagoyim to the river Kishon. And Deborah said to Barak, "Up, for this is the day in which the Lord has given Sisera into your hand. Does not the Lord go out before you?" So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him. And the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and all his army before Barak by the edge of the sword. And Sisera got down from his chariot and fled away on foot. Barak pursued the chariots and the army to Harosheth Hagoyim, and all the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword. Not a man was left. But Sisera fled away on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. For there was peace between Jabin the king of Hazor and the house of Heber the Kenite. And Jael came out to meet Sisera and said to him, "Turn aside, my lord, turn aside to me, do not be afraid." So he turned aside to her into the tent. And she covered him with a rug. And he said to her, "Please give me a little water to drink, for I am thirsty." So she opened a skin of milk and gave him a drink and covered him. And she said to him, and he said to her, "Stand at the opening of the tent. And if any man comes and asks you, 'Is anyone here?' say no." But Jael, the wife of Heber, took a tent peg and took a hammer in her hand. Then she went softly to him and drove the peg into his temple until it went down to the ground while he was laying fast asleep from weariness. So he died. And behold, as Barak was pursuing Sisera, Jael went out to meet him and said to him, "Come, and I will show you the man whom you are seeking." So he went into her tent, and there lay Sisera dead with the tent peg in his temple. So on that day, God subdued Jabin the king of Canaan before the people of Israel. And the hand of the people of Israel pressed harder and harder against Jabin, the king of Canaan, until they destroyed Jabin, the king of Canaan. An interesting story in Judges 4. And of course, the song of Deborah and Barak continues in Judges 5, in more poetic fashion, slightly different in the nature of that part of the text, which we won't spend time reading this morning. But this is one of the favorites in our children's classes and often in VBS tales about this woman who drives the tent peg through the head of Sisera. And there are a lot of things that have been said about this story in the past, a lot of characterizations given of Deborah or Jael or Barak, some of them accurate and some of them not accurate. I want to deal with some of that this morning as we look at the story. But what I really want us to see, and I want us to not be dragged away onto this other road that I'll mention here in just a minute, but what I really want us to see from the story is it is really a commentary on weak men. That's the nature of what's going on in this story. And some of the things that I say in the interaction with the concept here with the women may sound negative from our perspective in our society and the way we think of gender, but the reality is that's not really the consideration here in this text. And so hopefully that will be understandable. We think about it from their perspective and their standpoint, that really the comment here and the idea here is about the weakness of the men in this story. It's interesting throughout history in the interpretation of this text, so often Deborah has been painted in a very negative light, even much more so than Jael, and I think there's some reasons for that that maybe we will be able to talk some about this morning. One of these is that Jael seems to operate in a little bit more of a feminine fashion, and so she's not so much a threat to the masculinity of men who read this text. She kind of brings him into her tent, and she lulls him to sleep, and she is maneuvering, and she is acting in the way that a woman would act, right, as she's setting him up. And so that's not much of a threat. Where Deborah is much more of a threat to the ideas that men have about their own masculinity and what this looks like for Barak. As essentially, Deborah is telling him what to do, and he is so dependent upon her and the things that he is doing. And I will say, as we just read this text, and we think through it and we talk about it, that this sermon would not really be that popular. What we're going to talk about this morning is not going to be very popular in greater society. People, if they happen upon our website and they listen to what we're going to talk about this morning, they won't like it. And the reality is, many of us won't like it either, because we're so shaped by the way our culture works and the way our culture thinks about some of these things, where we want to have this idea of equality in the way that we think of equality, rather than realizing what is assumed here in this text is that men and women are very different. And what's actually happening in this text is that men are being pictured like women, and women are being pictured like men. And so there are these reversals that's taking place in the text, and there are some comments and some statements that are being made about this. In fact, one of the articles that I looked at in reading about this text was called A Tale of Cross-Dressers, Mothers, and Murderers, Gender and Power in Judges 4 and 5. Just the interplay of what's happening here with the men and women in the story, and how the point itself is that the men are acting like women, primarily. And they're being stated to be doing so through wording and through imagery. And in fact, the humor and the irony of this story really rests in the gender reversals that are taking place. And this is not the only place that does this. In some ways, the book of Judith, which is a non-biblical book, does a little bit of this. These kind of heroic women that stand up and then do the things that need to be done. And I would place this story really in that light. So much, I think, of the negativity of Deborah is misplaced, in my opinion, because what Deborah does is what Deborah needs to do. And it is not so much her fault what's taking place as it is the fact that the men aren't doing what they need to be doing. And so, as women tend to do, they do what's necessary in the moment. And I believe that's where we find Deborah, this woman who is a prophetess. She is the one who is judging Israel. She's taking care of the needs of the people because it's not being done any other way. And so not only is she operating as a prophetess in that role, but now she is forced into this other role where now she has to judge Israel. And all of this, keep in mind, comes because of poor leadership in the outset. This is not the first time that is said in chapter 4 and verse 1, this statement that Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. There is a problem of leadership. And the problem of leadership is not just coming on the national level. He sends deliverers. We have the Othniels and the Ehuds, the ones who come and for a brief period of time, they deliver and they save God's people. But the fundamental problem, the root of the problem, is more so deeper in society, where the families aren't led right. And as a whole, the people are not going in the right direction, to the point now where Deborah has to rise up and she has to do what she has to do, because men like Barak simply won't do what they're called to. And so as we're thinking about this, I want us to understand this idea about what's happening here in Judges 4 and 5, that God has some things to say here about gender. Now, I'm just going to say at the outset that I'm not going to even engage with much of what's going on in our modern society. I think most of this will naturally occur just as we think about some of what's said here and what is assumed by the writer of Judges 4 and 5 about the nature of femininity and masculinity. That there is a divide here. And that some of what we're going to look at, for instance, men being pictured like women and being called women even, and which is something that in our society is viewed very negatively, like it's some kind of terrible statement And it is, in a sense, in reality, just like it is here. But the way we view it in our society is that there's this inequality. We say a man is running like a girl, for instance. Well, that's a negative statement about inequality in our world, right? That's the way we perceive of it. But what they recognize here is that men and women are different. And it's not so much a negative thing about a man when he is called a girl because he would be called a girl, but it's because he's a man. And he's supposed to be a man. That's the really negative thing about it. And a woman in this society just as much does not want to be called a man as a man doesn't want to be called a woman, because they're different and they're glorious in their own ways by the creation of God and the way that he made them. And so at the outset, I want us to understand that concept from Judges 4 and from the ancient Near East and some of the texts we're going to look at that deal with this idea of the violence of war and what takes place with men and what they say about this when someone is weak. And they call them a woman in the context of war because they make this divide between what men do and what women do in the roles that they have. And so it is a statement about the weakness of the men, not that the women are lesser. And so understand that at the outset. Abimelech, keep in mind, a few chapters later, was horrified about the shame of a woman killing him. Remember that story? He's up against the tower, and she throws the millstone down, and it crushes his head. And he's still alive enough at this point to speak to his armor bearer. And he says, I want you to take this sword. Draw your sword and kill me, lest they say of me, a woman killed me. He doesn't want to be killed by a woman in battle. Right? He doesn't want that legacy. Because that's not what women do. Women don't battle. This is the arena of men, and he doesn't want that attached to him. And this is not the role of women, it's the role of men. And so Abimelech is worried about this. He's concerned about it. It's kind of misplaced, you think, as he's about to die, but still, it's something he is concerned about here. And the ancient Near East, really, it portrays this concept many, many times. It is a common way to shame weak men, to talk about them in the way that, for instance, Barak, and really Sisera as well, are pictured in this story. The ideal man was a strong, mighty warrior. A violent warrior woman was not the ideal woman. And I would venture to say that is actually true today as well. As much as we, in our society, want to push this agenda of making men like women and women like men, the reality is, at the foundation and the substance of the concept, we know there's a difference. And it surfaces all over the place. But it's interesting in these texts in the ancient Near East, and I'll give you a couple examples, they understand this very clearly. So, for example, this Hittite example of an oath or a treaty, it says, whoever breaks these oaths, let these oaths change him from a man into a woman. Let them change his troops into women. Let them dress in the fashion of women and cover their heads with a length of cloth. Let them break the bows, arrows, and clubs in their hands, and let them put in their hands this staff and mirror. In our society, people will be really, really offended by that statement. But what they're saying in the ancient Near East is, if you break this oath, you're like a woman in battle. Right? You're running away, you're weak. That is the place of woman in battle. Okay, that's the idea and how they pictured this in that world. The treaty between Ashur-Nirari V and the king of Arpad, Mithuli. If Mithuli sins against this treaty with Ashur-Nirari, king of Assyria, may Mithuli become a prostitute, his soldiers' women. May they receive a gift in the square of their cities like any prostitute. May one country push them to the next. May Mithuli's sex life be that of a mule, his wives extremely old. May Ishtar, the goddess of men, the lady of women, take away their bow, bring them to shame, and make them bitterly weep. Okay, this is the picture of what they're saying between men and women, and the difference of how these roles work. And the point is, these are weak men if they don't keep their oath. And so their soldiers are like women. That's not what women do. That's not how it works in ancient society. And so that's the point. It's not that being a woman is bad. It's that a man should not be a woman. That's the point. And that you're not much of a man if you're a man who acts like a woman. But it's not just in these non-biblical ancient Near Eastern texts that make these types of statements. Isaiah chapter 3, Isaiah has a few things to say about this, actually, and they actually coordinate pretty well with the story in which Sisera is pictured much like a child going into the tent of Jael, and she comforts him and gives him a little bit of milk and all this, much like a mother would, kind of the contrast, the paradox of what's happening here is she sets him up and then drives a peg through his head. But notice the words in Isaiah 3 and verse 12, my people, infants, are their oppressors. Sisera, he's like an infant. He's like a child. He's the oppressor for 20 years by the hands of Jabin. He is the commander of the army. And as God is talking about Israel and what ails them, it says, my people, infants are their oppressors, and women rule over them. Now, I assure you that Isaiah doesn't think that women are lesser or that women are bad, but what he's dealing with here is the nature of the roles and how they work, and that things are not the way they are supposed to be. A little bit later in chapter 19 and verse 16, as he is bringing down condemnation on Egypt, he says, in that day the Egyptians will be like women and tremble with fear before the hand of the Lord. The Lord of hosts shakes over them, the Lord of armies, right? This is in the context of war again and God bringing judgment. He talks about the Egyptians' hearts melting. And we know from Deborah there's some pretty fierce women. But that's not typical, and the ancient world knows that. That is not the area where they work and where they live typically. And that's what makes this story work. Because Deborah is operating outside of her normal role, really by necessity in many ways, and Jael is much the same way. We don't even always know exactly why they're having to operate in this way, but at the foundation, it's partly because, and mostly because, really, the men are not operating the way they need to operate. And it's interesting to me that the idea of social or even cosmic chaos is often a central theme of various articles or statements made about this text. You go read some things that are written about this text in Judges 4 and 5. In fact, I've titled my subtitle, this idea of social chaos, before I even came across this article that was about the cosmic chaos in Judges 4 and 5. The whole point is, this is not following the created order of God. Things are out of whack, we might say. It's not the way it ought to be. And so when things are not the way they ought to be, chaos ensues, there's confusion, and roles are mixed, and people don't understand how to operate, and that's exactly what's happening in Judges 4. And in this whole encounter, everything is twisted and turned, and things are not operating the way that they are intended to operate. It is likely that Deborah and Jael, neither one really want the roles they're forced into by the men in this story. But again, as I said, as women tend to do, they find a way to do what needs to be done. And we don't have time to go into the depths of this morning, but I will say that's a pretty typical standard, I think. That women are doers. They want to get things done, and so when their men don't get things done, they will get things done. And that's part of what's going into what I want to talk about this morning, about this idea of gender reversal and the social chaos that ensues when we as men don't do the things we're supposed to do. And so hear me again about this, especially you ladies. This is not something that's really as negative about you as it is really about me and about my fellow men in here and the way we need to be operating in the world, the way we need to be standing up and saying what needs to be said and fighting the battles that need to be fought for our families. And now not just passing that off to our wives and to our women to do for us, as Barak and the others in the story are doing with Deborah. Listen carefully to this concept within Judges 4. Despite Deborah being the one who's kind of running the show here, I want you to see this text frequently and subtly goes out of its way to make reference to her womanly and motherly roles. Her femininity is emphasized numerous times within Judges 4 and 5, and very purposely so, because she's a woman. And the text wants us to make sure we see that she's a woman, and that she's having to go beyond this role that she has into another realm that she really shouldn't have to do because Barak won't stand up and do what he needs to do. But in the introduction to Deborah in chapter 4 in verse 4, it says, now Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lippidoth, was judging Israel at the time. She used to sit under the palm of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim. Now, sometimes it's hard to see some of this because of the translation in English. And some of you, if you're familiar with another language like Spanish, and you understand maybe how verbs and how nouns work a little bit differently with endings and all that, you understand that a verb can actually have the feminine root within it, right? And that's something that's going on here. And in fact, her femininity is actually brought out four times in this short little text. Three of them are completely unnecessary for meaning. The point is, the writer wants the reader to understand without a doubt that this is a woman. If you took these things out, she sounds a lot like a man. The things that she's doing and the way she's operating, typically in the Old Testament or within ancient documents in general, if you didn't have the name and you didn't have all these statements about her being a woman, you would think this was a man. But it goes out of its way to emphasize the reality that this is a woman. She's a prophetess. She is a woman prophet. Not only that, she's a wife. Not only that, the verb itself contains the feminine root there. It doesn't even need this, but it puts the pronoun in there, which is often for emphasis. Right? It puts that she is sitting. It emphasizes it with the additional pronoun, which is completely unnecessary to get the point across. And so he wants us to see, even though it's hard for us sometimes even in English, but I think this story in general, as we read it, we get the feel for it. We understand what's going on here if we read it and we're honest with the text, that the emphasis here is Deborah, this woman, is doing something that Barak should have been doing. All of these men before him who are judging Israel, who are saving Israel, now Deborah is stepping up and she's the one doing it because Barak is running off somewhere else and won't come to the command of the Lord. Deborah in chapter 5, we didn't read this, but in chapter 5 in the song, she talks about herself in verse 7. She says, I, Deborah, arose as a mother in Israel. Now, you mothers, I think, can understand this, maybe more than us men. When there's something bad going on, I, the mother, arose. Right? She's ready to take care of it. This oppression, this bully who has been messing with Israel for 20 years, she said, I, Deborah, the mother in Israel, I arose. No more of this. Men, how often is this happening in our homes? I just got to ask. And I think there are husband and wife in these homes with children for a reason. We need both. But just think about that one dynamic that the mother arising when the things are happening saying, this needs to be taken care of. That's what Deborah's doing right here because Barak's off somewhere else. He's not taking care of business. And in a sense, this is embarrassing for Barak that he's not doing the things that need to be done. And so she is this mother in Israel, this subtle reference again to her feminine nature in this text. The same is true really of Jael. It's a little bit more subtle. There's imagery toward the end of the song that is really birth imagery. And the way she's pictured in connection and contrast to Sisera's own birth mother. In a sense, she falls between her legs when she kills him, kind of this sometimes called the death mother. She lures him into the tent and she puts him to sleep and gives him the milk and then she drives the peg through his head and he falls. The imagery is of birth, falls between her legs. So even in her operation of killing Sisera, she does this in a feminine fashion. And so all of this is pictured in this way that these women, they're still operating like women in a sense. Despite the fact that they are having to be violent and they're having to murder and they're having to do the things that the men should be doing in the text, they're still doing it in a womanly fashion. It's quite interesting. And so the interesting element of the story is actually the obvious shame of the men. Not acting much like men, and these women having to do that for them. The men are pictured as vulnerable, dependent, afraid. And in typical war language, whether it's in the Bible, as we've looked at a little bit, or in the ancient Near East, this is really where the women would fit into these roles when you're talking about the language of war. And yet the reversal is taking place where now it is the men who are acting this way and the women who are swooping in and taking care of business. Deborah is the shoulder to lean on for Barak. Barak needs Deborah. He will not go to war without her. In fact, she has to summon him. She has to call him and say, don't you know the Lord commanded you to go do this? Even this, to me, sounds a lot like a mother, right? Pulling the child in and say, don't you know this is what you're supposed to do? Right? She calls Barak. Has not the Lord, the God of Israel, commanded you to go and gather your men? Hey, it's time to get out there and get busy and get to work. Don't you know that God's told you to do this, Barak? And so Deborah has to kind of hound him a little bit, nag him to get out there and do the things he's really supposed to be doing when he's off somewhere else, not operating the way he's supposed to. I love the humor that's within this text. When you see some of the wordplay and some of these things, it's really the amount of them that gives you the idea. It's hard to say whether one or the other is specifically trying to do this. But I find it interesting in the story of Sisera, in the second part of this, that Sisera is running, for one thing. He's running from the enemy. He's pictured like this child. He's dependent as well, just like Barak. But this little reference here in verse 16, he takes off and he starts running from his chariot. It says, all the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword. Not a man was left. Not a man was left. Sisera's running. He's left. But not a man is left. He flees on foot to jail. She comes out and she brings him in. Kind of interesting, again, that the dynamic of the text, he actually uses a masculine imperative when he speaks to her about what he wants her to do. He, in a sense, maybe clumsily because he's so tired, but he kind of calls her a man through implication when he says, stand at the opening of the tent, and it gets even worse for him. If any man comes and asks you, is anyone in here, any man in here, you say no. He denies his own masculinity. Just the little ironies in the text. Or Jael and Deborah are doing the things that men do, and Barak and Sisera are doing the things that women do. That's the idea. They're not acting like men. And so the women are the violent aggressors, even the murder itself. I don't want to get too graphic here, but I will say this. The murder itself has imagery that reverses the roles. That the vulnerability of Sisera, where she drives the peg through his head, is a reversal of what typically happens between men and women in battle and war, where the woman is vulnerable. And the men take advantage of that moment, that she takes advantage of him asleep, weary, and drives that thing through his skull. And so, like I said in the beginning, the ancient people were not so concerned with our outrageously skewed concepts of gender identity or anything like that. A woman wouldn't want to be portrayed like a man, and a man wouldn't want to be portrayed like a woman. That's essentially the point. And each are by the creation of God, and they are glorious in his image. But to portray a man as a woman is an insult. Not because a woman is lesser or not as good, but because he's a man. And he's supposed to act like a man. And these stories work, a story like this story in Judges 4 and 5, they work precisely because gender division is so markedly assumed by these people. I assure you, they read this text and there's a lot of humor. The ancient people, they pick this text up and they read and they see what's happening here with Barak and Deborah, with Jael and Sisera. It's just kind of funny how it all plays out. And I will say this, that alone speaks plenty about the chaotic state of our modern struggles with gender identity and confusion of roles even in our world. You can draw your own implications from that. But I will say this about Judges 4 and 5. What it says is a man is a man and a woman is a woman. And they have roles to fulfill that are glorious in the eyes of God. Roles he created them for. And it creates chaos and confusion when they abandon those roles. And in Judges 4 and 5, it is the men who are doing so, who aren't acting the way men are supposed to act. And so let me sum this up just with a few points that I think are interesting here in the text, especially with Barak and what's taking place with him. And it is, first of all, that not knowing God's will, not knowing what God wants, is not typically the problem that we face. And really this applies to all of us, but we're talking a little bit more here about the men. It's not that Barak is just unaware of what God wants. He just isn't doing it. And that's why Deborah calls him back and says, has not the Lord commanded you? Go get the men. Go to war. We're being oppressed. Go take care of this. Don't you know what God wants? He's called you to do this. And yet, you're just sitting there in Kadesh Naphtali not doing anything. The next story with Gideon in chapter 6 would be much the same way if he wasn't prodded to do what God wanted him to do. He kind of shows the same sort of attitude. He doesn't want to get up and do what God calls him to do. He's very hesitant to act like a man and do what God's called him to do. And he's pushed, and so he finally does. But that's where we find Barak here. And so Deborah has to come in and summon him and call him and say, get up and act like a man and go out there and fight. And take care of Jabin and his army so that we can be at peace again. And so how often do we actually struggle with ignorance when it comes to our sins and our faults? For me, that's a difficult question. How often is it that I really just don't know? And how often is it that I just neglect the things that I do know? Like Barak's doing here. Did not the Lord command us to lead our families? Men, we know that. We know the expectations that God has for us in Scripture. And what he wants us to do. And so when we don't do that, is it a matter of lack of knowledge or is it a matter of neglect? And sometimes the reality in my life is that my wife has had to call me, summon me and say, it's time to do what you're supposed to do. I need you to be the one leading the family, not me. Right, we see that dynamic back in the beginning in Genesis, right? Her desire will be for her husband, but he will rule over her. That's the concept there. That we just let things go. There's going to be someone who takes charge. But God has a plan, and he wants it to operate a certain way. And when we neglect our duties, chaos ensues, and things happen that aren't supposed to happen. And we could talk all about the problems of dominant culture and the way they view gender and all of that, and there'd be some worthwhile nature to some of that. But what we really need to do, men, is talk about how we need to lead our families. And we need to stand up as men and be men in the home. But I like this next point that I think comes from the text as well. A point of comfort, at least for me, as I think about my faults and my failures in life, and that is what's stated at the end in verse 23. On that day, God subdued Jabin, the king of Canaan, before the people of Israel, and the hand of the people of Israel pressed harder and harder against Jabin, the king of Canaan, until they destroyed Jabin, king of Canaan. I'm not perfect. I don't always make the right choices. Sometimes I fail in my duties, in my roles, just like we all do, I think, at times. But the amazing thing is that God's plan, God's will, because he is sovereign, he is powerful, it's able to work despite my imperfections and the chaotic nature of things that I create in my own life because sometimes I don't do the right thing. And if we can hang on that hope, and that reality that God is sovereign, he is powerful, and I'm trying to accomplish the things that he does, sometimes it does take a Deborah to rise up in my life and make me realize that I'm not doing things the right way, and it's time to get things back in order. It's time to get rid of the chaos. Sometimes it's hard to see God's working in the world when the world seems so misshapen and out of order and so chaotic. And we have all this craziness that we see all around us all the time that seems so wacky and insane. But the reality is God is sovereign. And he will accomplish his will despite the failures of men. In Psalm 2, he just laughs at the enemies that try to come against them. They plot against them. They have all of their ideas. They think they're so wise. They've come up with all these things they're going to try to thwart the power of God and remove his king, and he just laughs. It's so silly. It's so ignorant. That God's will reign supreme. It's the same story that Daniel and his friends learn, and Nebuchadnezzar, and Darius, and Cyrus, and all the others in that story. They realize Yahweh, he's the Most High, and he gives the kingdom to whom he wills. And men can try to do the things that men try to do, but in the end, the sovereignty of God is going to win out and his will is going to be accomplished. And our world can try to reverse the roles of men and women and try to undo the created order of God all they want, but they will fail. And God will continue to call his men to be men and his women to be women and to fulfill their role and their function within his kingdom, which is infinitely more important than fulfilling any role or any function even within our society. And so that's my encouragement to you this morning, is to fulfill the role that God has called you to, wherever you are. If you're a man, if you're a woman, if you're a child, if you're an adult, God's plan will work, and he calls us to work for him in his kingdom, and we can all do that. And sometimes the difficulties we face and the things that become so hard because we reject that. We work so hard sometimes to do the opposite of what God has told us to do. And if we would just submit to his will and realize that he knows best, things would go so much better for us in our families, in our homes, in congregations, society in general. And so I encourage all of us to think about the story of Deborah and Barak, the story of Jael and Sisera, and thinking about being who I am. I need to be a man because I'm a man. If you're a woman, you need to be a woman because you're a woman. That's how God created you. Glorious, exactly how he wanted you. And stand up and be the kind of people God wants. Maybe that you're not in Jesus Christ this morning. We haven't talked a lot about Jesus this morning in this sermon. But the same still applies, the same concept. And he wants you to be in his kingdom, and he wants you to function in the way that you're supposed to function in his kingdom. And maybe the starting point for you is submitting your life to him in obedience. Submitting your will to his will, and you do so by being baptized into Christ for the remission of your sins. Getting rid of the old man and putting on the new. And saying you're going to be a different person. You're now going to live for God. You're going to live for Jesus Christ. Not for your own wants and your own desires. If we can help you do that this morning, why don't you come? We stand. We sing together.